I have a lot to talk about. I'll try to go through it rapidly. I should start by acknowledging all the keepers and trainers without whom I couldn't present any of the data or information I'm about to give. These people are dedicated and they work in amazing conditions. Why a talk only specifically on killer whales is itself worth trying to answer. There's an amazing amount of public interest in killer whales, perhaps more than in any other species. We can debate that, but I think perhaps more than any other species. There are websites all around the world that follow each single individual in captivity, and it's not just fringe websites. Down here is the Wikipedia. Wikipedia is fairly mainstream, follows each individual whale that's in captivity. They're the subject of a considerable political movement. There are bumper stickers and no whales in captivity, and friends don't let friends watch whales in captivity. When I go to marine mammal meetings, I'm often ostracized because I do captive whale research as opposed to wild whale research. I have to go in and out of my facility past protesters fairly frequently. So why there is a great deal of interest, why so much interest? One could say killer whales often are described as having great power. This is the scene where they're capturing sea lions is one of the most watched and rewatched scenes on television. Their grace and their beauty is admired by almost everyone. Why are they considered so beautiful is itself a topic of another talk and is such a worthy topic for study, why we love these kind of animals. There's now a bunch of psychologists who are finding evidence that it's our even young children are sort of born with a tendency to prefer stark black and white images. In any event, all of this public interest leads to them having enormous financial value. The marine parks bring in more visitors and more money than I guess all zoos, most zoos surely. There are people, it's not just their admissions, there are these people over here pay $500 a piece just to have dinner next to a killer whale pool. And imagine how much money is raised that way. It is not publicly discussed. It's probably nothing that anyone would probably say out loud. But each individual killer whale is probably worth $2 million, something in that range, which makes them the most valuable animals per head on Earth, more than thoroughbred horses, more than They are, they've been studied now extensively as individuals in the wild, and we know them to be very long-lived. Some individuals, even up to 60 or 70 years, an average lifespan into the 30s of years. They're very large-brained, the second largest brain on Earth, only to the killer whale, only to the sperm whale, second to the, they're cognitively complex. This is one of my own studies. My team looked at their ability to process mathematical mathematics at a very primitive level, and they're really good at it, as good as chimpanzees. And another reason why we might be talking about them today at this meeting is because they have had a spotty track record in captivity. This is a scene of their in the 1970s of the initial captures. It was a rough scene and continues to be. There are still teams of former Navy SEAL type people who are in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, who are still trying to capture killer whales to serve the aquarium market, and it looks similar, and it's similarly very rough. The animals were brought into very small pools. These are examples from facilities all around the world in the 70s and the 80s, and they didn't do particularly well. They have a There have been publications on this. They have a relatively shortened lifespan in captivity, so they don't do particularly well. But I also want to emphasize that those conditions were not unique solely to those days. These are two photos from today of facilities that continue to exist that could be argued as remarkably small for the size of the animal and remarkably limited in terms of the number of individual animals that are grouped together and so on. And this, of course, is in contrast with what is true for most species. Most species live longer lives in captivity, and in our zoos, and we're proud of it. We can be proud of that. A problem of gerontology is a common problem in zoos, and it's not a problem in the killer whale industry. So we in the zoo world, we can say that it deserves special attention because it's one of our special cases, or our problem cases, sort of like elephants and African dogs. Killer whales, we sometimes say those are the three species that have the shortened lives in captivity, although improvements are being made. I'm a big fan of Marion Stamp Dawkins, and I'm particularly a big fan of this particular book, in which she established six criteria for assessing the welfare of non-human animals in captivity. Cynthia, you asked for a quick answer to the question. Here's my quick answer to the question, or at least it's Marion Stamp Dawkins' answer. So I want to spend my time now going through each of these six, looking at the killer whale. First is evidence of injury or sickness. Your veterinarian examines your animals. If the animal is injured, it's not good. But killer whales are probably among the most difficult of all species on which to perform a veterinary examination. It's not like you can go in with them, and so when they're trained, and of course all killer whales in captivity are trained, they're trained to present themselves for visual inspections. This is what it looks like. This is a scene from SeaWorld, and in fact sometimes they're trained to even beach themselves like this to allow for sometimes for inspections. This way they also can provide with training voluntary fecal samples or voluntary urine samples, which are otherwise not available. But that's a rare case, and all of us who train animals know that when they're sick, it's when they don't do that. A sick animal is not going to come over and present itself, even though it's been trained to do so. So they can be, in fact, beached at times. If the facility is designed correctly, they can be moved into smaller pools where the water can be drained. They can be temporarily beached. But even then, the veterinarians in the room are wondering, what would I do with an animal like that? It's not like there's not too much I can do. The hope would be that you would put it into some sort of MRI scan or take an X-ray, but that's not really practical. This is a very small a false killer whale being scanned. It's to illustrate that it's not possible for a large animal like a killer whale, so you're largely left only with visual inspection. Sometimes you see scenes like this, so look for yourself. Tell me what you think. These animals okay? They're scarred up, marked up, but this is judged as fairly normal. Rake marks are normal in marine mammals, and a certain degree of roughness is natural for animals like this. And so these don't usually cause concern. Lesions like these do cause concern. They're usually the first sign of problems with water chemistry, things that can be fairly readily corrected. But sometimes it's horrible. Sometimes it looks as bad as this, and this is obviously an animal who's declining on all kinds of dimensions and is starting down a very bad road, or already down a very bad road. But my main point here is that visual inspection is largely not particularly informative. I took this photograph 4 days before one of these two animals died. Which one of the two? Nobody in the audience, and nor any observer could tell, and so visual inspection has its own weaknesses. The second standard from Marion St. Dawkins is behavioral evidence of distress. If an animal is writhing, twisting, turning, looking like it's unhappy, it's probably unhappy. That's her argument. So tell me about this. So we saw this a number of times, and it immediately caused concern. Killer whales don't usually do that. This is first sign we saw of this one, at least in the facility that I was present at. And there was a possibility this animal was writhing. But on further inspection, I looked at it, and I noticed that certain triggers would cause it to happen. One of the first triggers was rain. When it would rain, he would start to do this. And other times, I caught him doing it shortly after there was a duck had landed, a very unwise duck had landed in a killer whale pool. And I eventually picked up on the fact that he sometimes had a feather in his mouth, and then at other times he had a leaf in his mouth. And I came in time to conclude with a very high degree of confidence that he was playing. He was sort of play fighting and tossing the feather and causing this leaf to slop back and forth in his mouth. And so the point of the story is that appearances can be deceiving. Writhing is a bad sign, but not all writhing is writhing, and we're not sure. So in the marine mammal world, behavioral evidence is usually concentrated on taking. Is that really my 5-minute sign? Oh my gosh. We usually concentrate on breath rates, diet. This is me now skipping ahead, diet fluctuations. Third standard is physiological evidence of stress. So it is important to measure cortisol. Cortisol has proved to be very reliable. We have now a lot of data on this, and cortisol rises in killer whales is a good sign that something is going to go wrong really soon thereafter. I strongly endorse monitoring cortisol as a regular practice. Marion Stunt Dawkins points out that reproduction can be taken as an indirect index of stress. If they're reproducing well, it's usually a sign that they're doing okay. The fourth standard is comparison with natural life. Their natural lives are amazingly complex. They're very social, very effective predators of very large animals. So we looked a lot at this. We have data on behavioral budgets. We have taken behavioral budget data in a situation where the animals were moved from pools like this, the 1980 style pools, into pools like this, pools that cost many, many millions of dollars. And we were asked to assess the impact of that move. We did. Let me go back. We found that the animals in these circumstances were surface resting 90% of their time. Wild killer whales surface rest 10% of their time. The animals in this pool, having now spent many millions of dollars, surface rested 60% of their time. So we can say that as the cup is either half full or half empty. It's a huge improvement, 400% improvement, but nowhere near like in the wild. So what's clearly needed, this is a common problem in zoos, is we need enrichment to break up their boredom. But there's a huge challenge with providing enrichment for killer whales. And here you see these keepers are devoted and constantly trying to do so. But we have just completed a study that all the enrichment efforts that we make have very short efficacy, very short, I mean, as in 5 minutes, catches their attention for 5 minutes or so, and then they're off to something else. There is animals that are frequently presented with toys, so-called toys, but the main thing that they want to do with toys is batter them, toss them, and eventually expel them from the pool, and I mean within 5 minutes. Within 5 minutes. They like to batter things. And to give them batterable things is what they need. And usually that is dangerous and ultimately is knocked out anyway, destroyed, knocked out anyway. They invent their own enrichment at times. And in fact, we have a whole branch of studies strictly on the predatory behavior of captive killer whales I'd love to tell you about. I've spent some time looking at, I have a lot of data on their social behavior in captivity, especially the longevity of their maternal infant relations, and in fact the effects of disrupting that in captivity. The point you made, Pat, earlier about the impact on elephants of doing this was so reminiscent of the same point being relevant to killer whales. We have data now on the effects of separating calves from adults and then bringing them back. Bringing them back with the adults to see if they can reintegrate into pods. And the short answer is they don't do it very well. The short answer is they don't reintegrate very well. And the short answer is separating calves from mothers has negative effects that are lifelong and lifelong. And I have data on that. The management of agonistic interactions in captivity is a huge problem. These animals fight. They don't fight very often. Over 8 years, we only actually witnessed 10 serious fights, which is great because they're so powerful killers. But in the wild, when they fight, they'll zip apart and be a quarter mile apart after only a minute. They'll display and then mix and match and come back together. We found in fights that occur in captivity that when the keepers rush to separate the animals, but when they're allowed to run their course, they go through a phase after the fight in which they go through what's called echelon swimming, very careful parallel swimming. And it indicates, and this is my, I'm rushing here, but this is my take-home message here, is that we've discovered that killer whales are among those species that go through a process of reconciliation, similar to what some certain social, highly social primates do. The fifth point is free choice of animals. This is a free choice study I did with sea lions some years ago. But the main point here is that animals can tell us, at least Marion St. Dawkins would argue, animals can tell us about what they want or what they need if you set up a design so they can reveal their preferences. Killer whale studies like that have not yet been done, but in our facility, you see, here's a killer whale, and here's a killer whale, and here's where they tend to like to stay. Here are 13 beluga whales and where they like to stay. And they have this whole pool that the killer whales tend to like over here. That is saying something, and it ought to be attended to, and I can't wait for studies like that to be done. The sixth and final standard is putting oneself into the animal's place, to use the golden rule. If you were a bat, would you like these conditions? If you were a lion, would you like these conditions? If you were a killer whale, would you be okay? Not if you were a human, but if you were a killer whale, would you be okay? I don't know if you recognize this. This is a Bronx and proboscis and chimpanzees in Los Angeles. When I go to these exhibits, and having seen these animals in the wild, I think to myself, we're getting close. This is starting to act like, these animals are starting to act like chimpanzees. I can see chimpanzee-ness happening in this exhibit. I ask you what you know about killer whales. When you look at this, are we getting close? And I think that we have to conclude that we're still left mostly with challenges for this particular species. So what should we do? I don't know, you stop warning me, but I am almost done, so if you'll allow me. One is phase out captivity. There are certainly people who want to do that. There are people who are screaming to phase out captivity for this species, and maybe this is one of those species that we shouldn't keep. We can't keep, so maybe we shouldn't. I'm not here to say that. I think that we will be keeping them. So should we continue to fine-tune the husbandry? Maybe so. But I think Pat Darby said it correct for elephants. It's maybe not the right question. Let's not fix what we've got, and maybe we should be thinking of some other way with this particular species. Wait for an artificial selection founder effect. This is, I put a picture of a snow leopard in here because I think many of you know, in the 70s, people were talking about snow leopards will never thrive, but a few did, and they became the founders for what are now the zoo population. It's not really snow leopards. It's a version of snow leopards that adapted to zoos, and maybe that will happen with killer whales. But I think instead we should be thinking always for every species for right fitting our facilities. And I have this photo because this is where I had my epiphany. I was in a Toronto Zoo 30 years ago, and I was not a big fan of most zoo exhibits 30 years ago, but I watched this weasel in a very large enclosure. The enclosure was as large as this stage area, and this weasel was zipping around and climbing and scurrying and digging and climbing, and it reminded me of weasels I had observed in the wild, and I thought, okay, so it can be done, at least on this large scale. For this small species, it can be done. What can we do for the species? I think the answer actually has been provided by the Free Keiko Association. The Free Keiko movement, Keiko is the killer whale from Free Willy, was brought back to Iceland, and an artificial bay was created, and it was shown that and husbandry procedures were actually developed for handling a killer whale in a large enclosure like that, and interactions with humans still were maintained. So my suggestion is 50 years from now, we can, and there are natural harbors like this, 50 years from now, we can foresee a scene where killer whales are kept in facilities that are measured in miles, but yet still could be part of a human-animal interaction, perhaps still be involved in shows, still fed, but given the opportunity to live in their mostly natural social conditions and mostly natural environments. Maybe not tomorrow, but it's my dream that maybe in 50 years. I think I'm getting the 1 minute sign. Thank you very much. And so I stop with these beautiful pictures. This is how I spend my mornings every morning. I'm so lucky. Thank you.